We'll continue our mountaintop look at repeater linking in 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. For January 13, this is the Rain Report. I'm Kent Peterson, KC0DGY. If you have ever served on the technical committee of an urban repeater that maintains links to multiple receive sites, you already know that keeping those links functioning properly can be a real character builder. Now imagine a handful of mountaintop repeaters that are linked together digitally. In the mid-1990s, Frosty Oden, N6ENV, a CBS technical director at the time, was trustee and builder of 7 mountaintop repeaters on 220 and 440 in Southern California.
We're accomplishing our linking system through 420, which there aren't too many frequencies left in Southern California, but we were able to grab some of those after actually a 6-year wait. It's pretty tough to get them. We also are fortunate enough to have high mountaintops. The lowest mountaintop, in fact, my hub center is at 3,000 feet. The highest mountain is 8,000 feet, and the average mountains in between are 5,000 that we're linking all these repeaters in. Southern California is pretty rocky, and we're fortunate in that regard. Here's a concept to somebody who's thinking about 900 megahertz or 1.2. There's been a resurgence in Southern California of 6 meters, and I just literally got off the phone with somebody who's putting in a statewide system linking on 6 meters. And even though 6 meters is noisy, the digital mode, I think, still would survive just fine on that. And it has a tendency not to necessarily have to be on tremendously high mountaintops. The only adversity would be when there is quite a bit of skip. That may cause a problem, but some of these guys are successfully doing it on greater hops using 6 meters where needed.
If you don't have mountaintops to work with and you only have 300, 400, 500, 600-foot sites to work with, will it be any more difficult or any less difficult with digital than with analog to link the sites to the hub?
I personally don't think so. Of course, we're using a very sophisticated digital system, which basically needs to confirm the digital information as being complete. Otherwise, it's resent, and it's sent in such a quick manner that you really don't know that there was that much of a delay. One of the other ways, of course, that you can transmit this information, and even on 420, is to use parareflectors, where you get quite a bit of gain out of your 420 signal, and so the hop may not be quite as clean as you'd want, but yet even at 400 megs, you're able to concentrate what you do receive into a pretty reliable signal. I think if you had the benefit of 600 feet even, you'd be able to do a fairly decent job. Naturally, frequencies attenuate roughly 3 dB per 100 megahertz. So when you're talking 900 and 1.2, I think you're fighting a losing battle when you're forced to live on the flatlands of America. But I've even tried some gunplexing where we shot a signal 30 miles and it was fine. We shot a signal 33 miles and it was dead. And especially with some of this tropospheric ducting, when you're going from 8,000 feet down through the troposphere, that part of the atmosphere that's above your head, and some of the heat waves and all can really disturb some of those lower high frequency radio waves, 900 and 1.2.
Is there an advantage to a parareflector over a good Yagi on UHF?
Again, very good question, Hap. A parareflector, which there are quite a few of those available, you can find a lot of 1.2 and 2 gigahertz microwave dishes around, because that used to be the mode of microwave many, many years ago. So there are quite a few of those around. In fact, there are quite a few of the old UHF parabolas that they used to use to pick up UHF that you can find at the swap meet. In fact, I just found a gorgeous Scala parareflector for $40, $35 I think I paid for it, at the swap meet. So you keep your eyes open, you can find them. They will add a tremendous amount of gain even when you're not at the gigahertz level. They will concentrate your power into your active element and provide quite a bit of gain into, say, a 400 megahertz receive antenna. The interesting thing about a Yagi, and a lot of people don't understand this, if you're up in the snow country, which quite a few of my repeaters are snowed in throughout the year, and they just have to operate as reliably as we can make them. And we spend a lot of money on non-RF things, polyphaser, lightning equipment, and good procedures and hardline and all that are part of RF, but things that a lot of people get to sneak away with, we don't get to. One of them is Yagis become very inefficient in snowed-in areas. Many people don't realize that when icing attaches to a Yagi, it will actually reverse direction many times, and so what you were depending on for gain forward will then have gain backwards, and so you'll be transmitting possibly to the ethereal sky and not actually making your contact. Also, unless it's made of extremely durable elements, ice and wind are relentless day in and day out. The wind vibration and the ice loading will just tear any of the amateur Yagis apart unless you go to an expensive Scala or something that was designed for the snow country. The other thing that they'll do is detune them, of course, right away because you're still dealing with water. And when it's in a semi-water state, in other words, when it's iced up at night and then it becomes liquid in the daytime, it will change the effective wavelength and actually short the antenna out, so a lot of the power will be lost as well. The professionals enclose these in big plastic enclosures to keep them from reversing, and many amateurs don't know that.
You're listening to an interview with Frosty Oden, N6ENV, a CBS television technical director in the 1990s and a trustee and builder of seven 220 and 440 megahertz mountaintop repeaters in Southern California back then as well. We'll conclude Hap Holly, KC9RP's Moments with Frosty, after I remind you that this is the Rain Report, available for transmission under the Creative Commons license and heard Saturday evenings on shortwave from Lebanon, Tennessee, on WTWW 5085 kHz. We'll be right back.
You're listening to The Rain Report from www.therainreport.com.
Are you a firm believer of silver connectors?
I've been through the arcing stage of hardline and heliac and all that arcing due to poor connectors. You know, it's great that we have all these Radio Shacks and whatever's in the world, but I don't believe their connectors are quite up to the standards of years ago of more commercially reputable firms. We've accidentally, should I say, used some of these cheaper connectors and definitely paid the price. I mean, here you have a mountaintop that you may have $35,000, $40,000 in a building. You have a tower sitting next to it worth several thousand more. You're running hardline at $6 a foot. You have all this gorgeous stuff in place, and then you use one of these cheap little connectors somewhere in that line, and that's where it fails. Your $10,000 repeater investment has now gone to zero, plus you've got to bring parts up there to fix it.
Aren't they actually called silver connectors?
Well, some are silver, some are brass, some are gold. It all depends on the manufacturers. It gets to a point where there are only about two or three manufacturers you ever deal with because they've been through the business and they supply only the best to the finest, and you better get online because all it takes is one little goof, as I had illustrated, and you're sunk. I mean, this site snowed in for 6 months and you're saving a couple of bucks on a cheap connector. It's just not worth it because the rest of your investment has to suffer.
Who do you recommend?
I deal mainly with Andrew Cable and Zellwave, the three big wire companies. If you're buying RG214 or 142 or some of this newer double-shielded miniature cable, they're only three companies I've dealt with great success. Well, actually four. I've dealt with Alpha Wire, which is pretty good. Belden, Times Mirror, International. Those four companies seem to consistently provide a government mil standard cable, and I certainly wouldn't buy anything that at least didn't meet minimum government mil standards.
What about Andrews? You mentioned them.
Andrews is a sweetheart of a company, at least in my estimation. Their prices are reasonable. They will cut you a discount for amateurs. They do ship smaller orders. I mean, a spool of cable is 5,000 feet. You can order it in 1,000-foot sections, but, you know, an amateur will call up and say, by the way, can I order 92 feet, 3 inches, with two female end connectors on it? Not a problem. We'll ship it out today. That kind of good dealing, I think, in your bigger life. I work for CBS Incorporated. Whenever anybody asks me, who do you recommend, I immediately go to the people who treated amateur radio operators the right way. This is what we're going to buy. I learned years ago that if it doesn't look good, it isn't going to work right. And so I've tried to make all of my installations as commercial looking. Basically, don't let anybody give you a bad rap about the word amateur and amateur radio. Amateur means somebody who is devoted to what it is that he is doing to ferret out what the answers are and do our hobby the best that we can. I think most of us want to be good neighbors with isolators on our repeaters. We want to give the best service to our users by putting pass cans and all that on our systems. I think that it depends on how much money you want to put into it to go into the digital age, but the controllers run anywhere from $1,200 all the way up to about $5,000. There are several of you technocrats out there that know how to sit down and do digital already with the computers that you have. It could be a homebrew system. Commercially made one, as I mentioned, starts at $1,200 for a good one. I've seen them as cheap as $400 even, if you don't care to have much for an auto patch memory. And then they go up to $5,000 if you're into the turnkey end of it. I think you're going to see quite a few more in the next 2 years as the art gets perfected. Any problems, any flaws in the system are readily accountable. Everything that happens can be recorded at a central site and logged. And the minute you have a problem, this log will tell you where the error is found. We started out with our version 1 software that had many flaws. I mean, the first one, I think we had over 100 flaws. Each succeeding piece of software has changed and improved what we've been doing. And then now, if there's a glitch in the power or a link is not talking correctly to another one, we can instantly pinpoint where the problem is. The other good thing is we're not dealing with tremendous voltages when we switch things. We're switching them digitally so we can get rid of clicks and noises and things like that. The only thing that we quite honestly have found is that we actually generate our own noise in there, which has been a little bit of a problem. We can get rid of the squelch tail, but we actually generate our own computer squelch tail. The other great thing about the digital era is you've got guys like me that are into the building of transmitters and receivers and things like that that I just thoroughly enjoy. And I really am not that much of a digital person. I mean, I'm as much as the average person in this technology is. And so I rely on other people that are really into this stuff. And it makes for a tremendous club unity. You have guys who can climb poles and put antennas up and connectors. You've got guys who can build the stuff. You got guys who love to make up cables. I love those people. The people who make up those short little stinking cables that have to be an odd wavelength, I just love those guys. They spend an hour on a cable and they just enjoy every minute of it, and I hate that. And then you have the computer people that sit down and they will spend literally days trying to ferret out problems, trying to program these things, trying to see what they can do, and it just makes for a tremendous camaraderie.
And that concludes our two excerpts from a 1995 conversation Rains Hap-Holly, KC9RP, had with Frosty Oden, N6ENV. In those years, Frosty was a technical director with CBS Television. He was also the trustee and builder of 7 220 and 440 mountaintop repeaters in Southern California. According to the QRZ.com, Frosty Oden now resides in Litchfield Park, Arizona. The Rain Report is copyright 1990-2018 Rain. All rights are reserved. Now, for all you mountaintoppers that catch this weekly podcast, either on therainreport.com or on shortwave Saturday evenings at 9 o'clock Central Time on WTWW 5085 kHz from Lebanon, Tennessee. I'm Kent Peterson, KC0DGY, bidding you a very 73 from the Radio Amateur Information Network. Keep on hamming.